In this final 407 edition, Lav and I recap an interesting week at the Memorial and give our survivor tips for golf's longest day. Welcome to the Golf Central Podcast presented by Callaway Golf. Did you know that John Rahm almost never hits full shots, 8-iron through lob wedge? He prefers to hit three-quarter shots that fly low, so a higher spin ball is a necessity for control. That's what he got in ChromeSoft X for his golf ball. Are you aware of the setup that 2014 U.S. Women's Open champion Michelle Wee West used last week at Olympic Club? Do you know why PGA champion Phil Mickelson uses a low-lofted driver combined with a longer shaft? If you like equipment notes like these, you're going to love Callaway's new World of Wonder website. Johnny Wonder takes you inside the tour truck and the bags of staffers on all world tours and inside the Eli Callaway Performance Center for all things equipment and fitting. What the pros are doing may just help you shoot your best score. Check out CallawayGolf.com/World of Wonder today. Lav, you survived Monday, golf's longest day, final qualifying for the U.S. Open. You were in Jupiter. I was up in Ohio. It's lovely in Ohio, by the way. Give me your survival tip. What was the one thing that you did? I'm guessing you were there the better part of 12 or 13 hours that got you through the day.
Try about 15. And my survival tip would be sunscreen. Because I was at the Bears Club in Jupiter. And if you've never been there, have you played that golf course, Rex?
I have not.
Okay. So it's basically like cut out of a forest. And there is basically the fairway and then sandy area, and then you're going to lose your golf ball. And so you're either completely unprotected by the sun in the fairway, or the sun is just radiating off of this crystal clear white sand. And so it got very, very hot. And it was probably blowing 20 steadily. I mean, it was low 90s. It was obviously typically early June humidity in South Florida. It was windy. I mean, this was not ideal conditions to have to play 36 holes in. And so I saw guys lathering up. It was like they were preparing for war and they're putting on their war paint to try and be like camouflage in their bunkers. Like it was seriously war painting. So I would say sunscreen, especially in Southeast Florida.
Have you ever been to Springfield, Ohio?
I have not.
Do you know what the S in Springfield, Ohio means?
The what?
The S in Springfield, Ohio. Do you know what it means?
No.
Simple. It's a very, very simple place, Lav. There was nowhere to get dinner after, I don't know. I mean, we finished up at 10 o'clock, but there was nowhere to get dinner after 7 o'clock. It's a very, very quiet little town. It's Mayberry. It's beautiful. It's idyllic. You know what they don't have in Springfield?
Gas stations.
Very good internet service. And when you're on a golf course,
terrible service at the Bears Club.
15 hours and you have to stay on top of leaderboards. And I'm going to be honest here. And I think both of you, both you and I are going to attest to the same thing, that even though we cover golf for a living and we like to think of ourselves as experts, when you get to one of these qualifiers, probably less you than me, you start looking down the leaderboard and you think to yourself,
who,
how is that guy in this field? I've never even heard of him.
You want to try Sahith Thagala's pronunciation again?
Sahith. I thought I got that right. Did I not get that right on air? I got it wrong.
I think he had like an 80% success rate. He of course was in the qualifiers there.
That was And it was a really good story, by the way. Got off to a terrible start, but I say all this only to point out that it's a challenging day and it's a day that both you and I enjoy. It's a day that our company cherishes. And the reason why, and I had this conversation with a colleague before I left Ohio last night. And the reason why is it's as authentic as golf can get. I would argue it's the most authentic thing our company does, simply because there aren't big paychecks. There aren't stars. Now there was Ricky Fowler at one of them, but normally these aren't stars that are driving the boat. And every other week out of the year, you and I can attest to this, that we are a star-driven entity, that we're going to look at the Tiger Woodses and the Phil Mickelsons and the Rorys and the Dustins and all of these top players. And we don't spend enough time on the other players because that's not what drives traffic. That's not what people want to see. It's understandable. I get it from a business model. For one week out of the year, it's fun. It's authentic to be able to go and learn these other stories and tell them. And you did it very, very well.
So I was trying to explain to my wife.
Really?
What final qualifying is for the U.S. Open.
Did she really want to know, or are you just boring her?
Well, she was like, what are you going to be doing for 36 hours? It was basically explaining away my absence. And so I told her, like, I could qualify for the U.S. Open. Like, no. That is the beauty of this major championship. I could, in theory, qualifier for the US Open. If I get to the pre-qualifier, the local qualifier, and then of course the final qualifier in order to get to Torrey Pines. Extraordinarily unlikely, never going to happen, especially since I apparently don't play golf anymore, as we're now 2 months removed from my last round. But that is the essence of this golf tournament. It is the most democratic of the majors. I would argue it's the weakest field of the four majors, because you're only having the top 60 in the world ranking, various other exemptions, but that's not what people want or have come to expect from the US Open. They come to expect really difficult conditions and also these dreamer type stories. It's highly unlikely that any of these are going to come to fruition, right? I think Lucas Glover was the last US Open champion who had to go through qualifying. Yeah. Correct. So we're now a dozen years removed from that. However, that's not to say you're not going to be able to spotlight certain players, whether they're young up and comers like Cole Hammer, who just got into the field on Wednesday, Akshay Bhatia, who got through at a playoff in South Carolina, Joe Highsmith, who I just covered at the NCAA championship. He was kind of the hero for the Pepperdine team. He gets one of the two spots on the West Coast. And at the final qualifier that I was covering in Jupiter, Florida, was a player who got through by the name of Thomas Aiken. And if you're a hardy golf fan, you might know the name Thomas Aiken, mid-30s, South African, three-time winner on the European Tour. But when going over his record just to see what he'd done recently, he's barely played. I mean, you can count on almost one hand the number of tournaments that he's played in the past 3 years. And so while walking over to the live shot to conduct our interview for our six-hour marathon Golf Central to wrap off golf's longest day, I said, you know, where you been? You know, where did this come from? And he said, you know, I've had some issues with my wife. And I was like, oh, okay. I'm sorry to hear that. He goes, yeah, it's been a tough couple of years. I said, do you mind if I ask you about that? He said, you know, just tread carefully. I said, okay. And so, you know, I kind of asked generically about his last couple of years, and he mentions the issues with his wife and, you know, kind of how it affected his desire to play. And so off camera, I said, Do you mind me asking what happened? He said, sure. 10 days after his wife delivered the couple's second child, his wife hemorrhaged in the doctor's office. If she was not in the doctor's office, she said she probably would have died. What came from that was a 9.5-hour medical procedure that required 11 blood transfusions. She currently has all sorts of blood disorders stemming from this. He said, you know, physically she's okay. Mentally, the ordeal over the past 2 years has really affected her. That was in April 2019. Then he's trying to get back to playing on the European Tour. Hurricane Dorian destroys the family's home in the Bahamas, which is then how he fled to Florida and wound up at the Bears Club, which, of course, is where this qualifier was. And then last year, of course, was the pandemic. And COVID-19 affected the European Tour schedule much more than it did on the PGA Tour. He's played six times since spring 2019, and yet he was one of the players who, in a very strong field in Jupiter, Florida, on a very difficult golf course at the Bears Club, was able to get through. Is Thomas Aiken going to win the U.S. Open? Probably not. But that's not why we love this major championship, why we love golf's longest day, and why we love telling those stories, because it's not, hey, what are Brooks and Bryson and Rory and Phil all up to?
Okay, you tend to yammer when you get on these stories, and very good storytelling there, by the way. And I knew you had one locked and loaded because I read your tweet.
Oh, locked and loaded,
which is good, because I was going to ask you when I finally got back to my hotel Monday night, and I had to stay over because I was doing Springfield, but I had to step in for Todd Lewis on Tuesday because Columbus went to the playoff. So I was up in my hotel room late Monday night, and I was watching all the different reports coming in from the field. And it's really amazing when you think about all the moving parts of this 12
Herculean effort to put that on television.
And I'm going to drop names. It was Matt Hegarty who did just a fantastic job of getting all these folks together. There were so many people behind the scenes that do this, but I was amazed as I was listening to all the different interviews, and I'm going to call it Berko won Monday. He completely won Monday. And I don't even know if I can say he won because of anything that he did, but he had the only qualifier that cried on camera. And I was so mad. I was throwing things at Berko's, my wall.
That is Berko's MO. It doesn't matter what's going on in your life.
So
he's going to draw it out of them. Oh, I don't know why.
I was livid. Like, and I had some good stories and I enjoyed talking to the people that qualified at my site. And I thought that it was fun reporting and it was a good day and the whole nine yards. And then the next day at Columbus, but Burko got someone to cry on camera. And I'm thinking he wins. He wins the day.
Burke, like, doesn't matter if it's the U.S. amateur, he gets the winner to cry. At the NCAA championship a couple weeks ago, he got Michael Beard, the head coach of Pepperdine, to cry. I was like, what are you even crying about? Like, he's talking about his father. Your father's still alive. He's right there. Why are you crying? And yet they just see Burko and the waterworks start. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
He's the Oprah of the Golf Central reporters, isn't he? You get on the couch really with him and that's it. You're going to, it's very, very good. I know I jealousy. It's the height of jealousy, but it's, I'm very, very proud to be on the same
who
team.
Who were the main qualifiers who maybe they don't have a great chance, but who do you think could maybe sniff some contention at Torrey Pines?
We just taped some segments that are going to run next week, some video segments on golfchannel.com. And you got one, and I think we were on the same page on this beforehand because I spent some time talking to him at Memorial before he headed down. As Brendan Grace, I think he's got a very, very good chance. I mean, I like the way his game is. He plays Torrey Pines well. You had a chance to get to know him. I think his confidence is as high as it's been in a very long time.
How about your boy Sahith?
I do. I don't know that I've seen anything out of him in PGA Tour events yet. And it was a fun story.
Someone give him a chance. He's a good player. Haskins Award winner in 2020.
Very good player. And he played well last week at Jack's Place because he was a Nicklaus Award winner last year. He got an exemption and he made the most of it. I think tied for 37th. And I mean, I think he'll be comfortable going back to Torrey Pines. It's a golf course that he's played a lot. It's a golf course that a lot of these younger players have played a lot, which I'm interested in.
I think the Junior Worlds Tournament was kind of big. Now, I've never seen the golf course in this type of condition with 4 to 5 inch hack out rough. But they can at least have their sight lines down.
Now, and I will say this, this is nowhere near as good as your Aiken story because no one was in danger of dying. But the one that really fascinated me was when I had to go back to Columbus to pick up the final end of that qualifier. And one of the qualifiers from the playoff was Peter Melanti. And I just talked to him real quick. He birdies the first playoff hole and he's walking to his car. First time he's ever, and this is a veteran. This is very much a journeyman.
I was going to say, who is Peter Melanti?
He's a journeyman. He's just a guy that's never qualified for a U.S. Open. He's a professional. He's a good professional.
What tour does he play on?
Oh, the PGA Tour. I'm mispronouncing his name.
Is it Malnati?
Yes, Malnati.
Peter Malnati.
That's it.
Peter Malanti.
He's Peter never Malnati, qualified.
One of the nicest human beings.
Nicest human beings in the world. And I just butchered his name, so that's on me. However, Peter Malanti. He had tried to qualify. He had been in five previous playoffs to get into the U.S. Open, and he birdies the first hole. That's the end of the story. But he was telling me after the fact that he goes, I never thought I was going to get to play in one. Like, I just assumed I'd come close this many times, and I never thought. And you think, I mean, to your point about the great stories, you're right. It's not going to be the strongest of the major championship fields, but you're going to end up with all of these really good stories.
Peter Melanti. His name is Rex Hoggard. It's a 407, 768, something or other. He lives in Longwood. If you would like to hunt him down, Rex, you were also at the Memorial Tournament. Were you at plenty of drama to sort through, especially on Saturday night? How about this? I want to ask you this question. What was the story that you were planning to write as of 6 p.m. Eastern time Saturday? And what was the story that you ended up writing as of, let's say, 6:05 p.m. Eastern time Saturday?
If I'm being completely honest, I had kind of mailed in a column early. And so there was already a column.
You mailed in a column early?
That's right. I had kind of mailed in a column early.
This is my shocked face.
Yes, I know that's what it looks like. However, in this particular instance, I kind of knew that Rom was going to have a commanding lead and that I was going to have to circle back around and do something bigger on him. The interesting thing to me was as it all went down, and we can dissect this however you want, but there was two things that stood out to me. One, I'm still not 100% sure why that had to happen right out in the open in public. Like, they could have waited for him to get behind closed doors and had this conversation, and it still would have been a shock. It still would have been something that's going to reverberate through the tour for quite a while, but it wouldn't have been just this scene that, you know, we're going to keep showing that footage over and over again of him getting the news from the tour medical expert. And that's who that was, by the way. I was thrown by that. And I was also thrown by the idea. And I followed up the next day with a column about this. And I was on the wrong side of Twitter, which doesn't particularly bother me. But just as a way of an explanation, the medical expert, it was the only man around that green complex of hundreds of people wearing a mask. And I thought the irony here is that one man is wearing a mask and he's the man that's telling the guy that's leading that you're out of the tournament because you tested positive for COVID-19.
Yeah, that's the tour's medical advisor, Dr. Tom Hospel, who was instrumental in getting the PGA Tour back up and running at Colonial after, a 3.5 month absence. I'm still curious of the timeline because they knew, I believe, at 4:30. And so the tour thought it was okay for Rahm to mingle with his playing partners at that point. And fans and whoever else might be in his vicinity, his caddy. But then all of a sudden you could not subject him to being close to them, even with a mask on in the scoring area. What was their explanation for why they had to confront him on the 18th green as opposed to, hey, let's interrupt his round and force him out?
So the timeline to catch everyone up and just to fill in all the blanks, John had gotten caught up in contact tracing, which means if you're not vaccinated, which John is not, I mean, he didn't say it, but it's obvious because of the way the tour protocols work, he was not vaccinated. Because of that, he had to be tested every day because he was in these protocols as a possible high risk because he had been in close contact. The test between the second round, which was delayed, and the third round came about mid-morning on Saturday. The first result of that came back at 4:05, as you just pointed out correctly. The protocol at that point is to retest the same sample to make sure it's not a false positive. And that's what they did. That came back at 6:02, which was very, very close to about the time he finished his round. I think he was on the final hole when they got the last of the information to answer that. So the timing of it was he was just finishing up his round when your sausage finger didn't do it. I understand you have something to say. However, in this particular case, the one part that I think everyone's going to have a question about is why just pull him to the side. Don't do that out in public. That was unnecessary.
No, that's not. I think the optics of that were terrible. No, the question that I received most from my friends who are just, I would say, casual golf observers is why couldn't he just play as a single on Sunday?
Well, because the protocols have been in place since the beginning, and we're sneaking up tomorrow. Actually, it's going to be the 1 year anniversary. Oh, no, 2 more days. It's going to be on Thursday. It's going to be the 1 year anniversary of the restart back at Colonial. And there have been cases of this where it happened. Brendan Grace being the most high profile before this one. And Reno last year, he was in second place through 2 rounds, woke up Saturday morning, didn't feel great, did what he should have done, went to the tour doctors, and they tested him, and he came up positive and had to withdraw. And so the protocols have always been to follow the CDC guidelines.
But can't you change the protocols? It's been a year.
No, I don't think so, because these aren't tour protocols. And this is what my column was about. And again, I ended up on the wrong side of Twitter, and that's always a difficult place to be.
I saw you got ratioed on Sunday.
I did. It was harsh. And I kept coming back to the idea, and I didn't even notice. It was my wife who noticed, of all people. And she's like, she texted me, and she's like, you realize you're getting killed on Twitter. And I go, I know. Like, I'm not worried about
not the first time. Certainly won't be the last.
Won't be the last time.
Just carry on.
Because my point in all of this is I wrote that based on the idea that we have hundreds of people around the green. And as I pointed out, only one person had on a mask. And that's all about. And that one person was telling John Rahm that he couldn't play anymore because he tested positive. And it's easy to look at that green and think to yourself, which you just did, you know, we're on the other side of this. Maybe we need to start changing the rules. And what I don't want to tell Twitter, because I don't like engaging on that platform, because I feel like all people want to do is scream, and the louder you scream, that's the person who feels like they're going to win, is this has nothing to do with politics. This has nothing to do with whatever your belief in science is. This has to do with reality. I'm not asking you to suspend your beliefs, but I'm asking you not to suspend reality. And the reality is the tour has to follow the CDC guidelines. And that's exactly what happened in this particular case. And that it's probably going to happen again before everything is said and done. To hear the players talk, they know that this is not going away anytime soon. We're taking the mask off now. We're mingling in public. We're allowed more and more fans out to golf courses, and that's great. But that doesn't mean that we've won. There's still plenty of work to be done, and that was the point of my column.
How do you think this is going to affect player perception? I know the PGA Tour came out and said just over half
50.
Of the PGA Tour membership has been vaccinated at this point? Do you think there's going to be a mad rush to get some shots in arms after seeing what John Rahm went through? Or do you think these guys who are just set in their ways and they have zero intention of actually going through with the vaccination process?
No, I would think so. And again, I pointed out in the column, and it didn't seem to do any good, that getting vaccinated, not getting vaccinated, I certainly understand arguments on both sides. That's entirely up to you. It's your personal decision. I don't care if you want to get vaccinated or you don't. That has nothing to do with me. But in this particular case, when you see what it cost John Rahm, who obviously was not vaccinated, and he paid the price for it. And that was a really, really steep price that he had to pay. So yes, I think more and more players start coming around to the idea that I'm just going to do this for no other reason than it just makes your life easier, because suddenly all of these protocols start to loosen up. You don't get caught up in contact tracing. And okay, so now I don't have to worry about testing every single week or every single day if I come into contact with someone. There are benefits to this that can't be ignored.
Correct. So just to put a fine point on this, had John Rahm been vaccinated, he would not have even fallen in to this contact tracing program, because you're vaccinated. Nothing bad can happen to you. So that's where I would put a fine tooth point on that. I also want to circle back on this timeline now when it comes to John Rahm. So obviously he had to withdraw from the Memorial Tournament on Saturday night. He would have fulfilled his quarantine requirements on Tuesday morning of U.S. Open week, unless this week, and we're not with John Rahm, we do not know if he is doing this, unless he has two tests within a 24-hour period in which he tests negative, correct?
Correct.
So there is a possibility, and John Rahm might be doing this on his own anyway, where he can still prepare and practice for the U.S. Open as normal, and if he goes through that process and has the two negative tests, can show up just like everyone else for U.S. Open week Sunday or Monday at Torrey Pines and prepare as normal. If not, the latest he would be there is Tuesday morning. Is that correct?
All that's correct. And he's still, I mean, like I said, we just tape these things, and I think both of us are in the same mindset, regardless of everything that's happened, maybe because of everything that he's had to go through the last week. He's still one of our favorites, and simply because he loves that place.
He's absolutely still one of the favorites. I think back to Augusta National just a couple of months ago. He came in hot to Augusta National, didn't even play a practice round. Ended up playing a 9-hole practice round on Wednesday morning after the birth of his first child over the weekend. Didn't really affect him all that much. Still finished in a tie for fifth. This is an elite player with an elite game. He still has a very capable caddy in Adam Hayes who can go scout the golf course and tell him exactly where he needs to hit it.
Adam's really good caddy. He's one of the best.
Excellent caddy. Absolutely excellent caddy.
I'm glad you've come around on him. I think it's interesting that we've talked for the better part of 30 minutes, and we have not mentioned the story that in my mind would have been the one thing that we could have sat and talked for hours about, which is Brooks Koepka and Bryson DeChambeau in this.
Because I'm over it.
The feud. I'm over it too. But before we move on, and we're not going to move on because we'll talk about it next week when we get to Torrey Pines, and it'll be an issue because they'll both be in the same field again. In the early stages of this, I think we could have all seen how this was just an unfortunate incident that could have been avoided, and that plenty of people work together and don't like each other, Ryan.
What are you hinting at?
I think that's the beauty of this podcast. People can't tell. Like, maybe they're friends, maybe they're not.
I've gotten multiple. Do you guys hate each other or do you love each other? I don't know.
That's the beauty of it.
It depends on the day.
It comes and goes. IPAs are involved. But it escalated when Brooks did what he did after the fans were, you know, mocking Bryson all week long, really. At every turn, they're calling him Brooksy, and he's trying to play it off, and clearly it's bothering him, and he's trying to say all the right things. And then Brooks does the video on Twitter, essentially rewarding this kind of behavior. And two things. One, it's flat-out bullying. Like, if one of my sons did this, I would sit down and have a long talk about that's not acceptable. That's not acceptable behavior, and that's not the way we treat other people. And I'm not doing that to Brooks, but this is clearly bullying. The other half of it is, and this is amazing to me, the tour has to step in and do something about this eventually. No?
You would think so. I mean, Brooks Koepka is 31 years old. Like, I can understand you've got kids who have either graduated from high school or are still in high school. I mean, I could understand if you're 14, 15 years old, you don't know wrong and right. You don't understand bullying. You don't understand the psychological effects that that could have. I get it. You know, you're growing, you're learning. Brooks Koepka is 31 years old. Like, grow up, dude. You're picking on the nerdy scientist kid who might be a little bit different. It might be a little bit socially awkward. And you know, he's nerdy. You don't understand all the things he's doing. Bryson DeChambeau, he made a lighthearted jab at Brooks's six pack, his physique a couple years ago with the body issue. That is not on the same plane as what Brooks is now lobbying, including the vitriol that he has deep in his heart towards Bryson. Those are not two comparable things. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I'd absolutely agree with that.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I don't know how the PGA Tour steps in and, I mean, you just tell him to knock it off. Like, Brooks and say, I can do whatever I want. I'm an independent contractor. I know I have PGA Tour regulations and you can fine me for conduct unbecoming. But you also just dangled this $40 million player impact program in which if I can drum up interest and have people talk about me and I can be a needle mover and people are talking about me on social, then I can be fiscally rewarded. And so I'm not sure what the tour can say to Brooks other than, hey, we'd really appreciate it if you stopped, mocking and getting your band of baboons to go shout at Bryson.
No. And I think what's going to happen here is he crossed the line and we can call it bullying, but there is a competitive element to this where whether or not if Bryson was going to play well last week or not, doesn't really matter. What matters is you suddenly have one player encouraging baboons, I think is the word that you just called them. Band of baboons to yell things while Bryson is playing. Now we all know that yelling in the middle of the backswing is that's not cool. It happened a couple of times, but even if it's not in the middle of the backswing, there is still an element of this where you're kind of, I don't particularly understand like how he can get away with this. I mean, you don't even have this at the Ryder Cup. And that is very, very much, you're going to pick sides on that one, depending on wherever it's being played. And just to cut to the chase, the column that I had written Friday was about this specifically because I'd gone out and I'd walked with Bryson because I wanted to see the fan reaction, and it wasn't great. And my argument, and I've made this argument before, was golf always wants to be a mainstream sport until it gets to the ugly underbelly of mainstream sports, which is obnoxious fans, drunk fans, fans doing things that we're not used to them doing at golf tournaments. And that's where we're at right now. And if you don't want to be
Brooks thinks he's growing the game. He defended it Wednesday at Congaree, saying he's just trying to grow the game. How is this growing the game?
And maybe he is. I stake my flag on this one, and it's bullying, and it shouldn't be acceptable. However, in this particular case, either we want to be a mainstream sport or we don't. And in mainstream sports, fans are ugly. We've seen it in the NBA where it's gotten wildly out of hand. And in this particular case, fans were being escorted off Muirfield Village just for yelling Brooksy after Bryson hit the golf ball. And my argument was, all right, it's uncomfortable. It's really not cool. But is that really an offense that gets you kicked off property?
Yeah, that's a little bit of an overreaction. I can't tell. And there's been some varying accounts of whether Bryson's asking for the fans to remove, Bryson's agent's asking for the fans to remove. It's a little bit of a tricky situation there. I do know one thing, Rex. The more that you talk about something affecting you, the more that those fans are going to try and heckle you. And so something needs to be done. You would hope that at 31 years old and the guy who's being the bully here would get reprimanded and he would have to come out and say, hey, I was wrong. I should not have tried to incite this type of reaction against one of my fellow competitors. That's not cool. I'd rather let my clubs do the talking and beat him that way. I don't want to win because you just taunted Bryson on the 71st hole. He missed a putt and he was kind of affected that way. Like, why would you want to win that way?
You wouldn't. And you don't want that kind of behavior. And the argument I was just making is either we want to be a mainstream sport or we don't. Because it's not pretty. We've all seen what's happened in the NBA. We've all been to NFL games. We've been to baseball games.
I'm actually surprised, Rex, now that gambling is taken off how it is, that we haven't had a situation where 72nd hole of a golf tournament, a fan who's got a lot of money riding on, say, someone's opponent, doesn't try to alter the outcome. I've been actually somewhat impressed that it hasn't gotten to that point, but it wouldn't shock me at all if we get there in the next year or two.
I could see it. All right. Before we get out of here, I said at the top of the show, I'm going to clarify now. This is the last 407 episode. By that, I mean, we live in the 407 air code, Lav and I. Speaking of that, we live in the 407 area code. Lav is no longer going to live in the 407 area code. He's relocating to parts up north. Where are you going, Lav? Why are you going? You're leaving me. You're leaving us.
Going to Ponte Vedra. So you're right. I'm taping this. And I know this is just a podcast and not a video podcast, but there is literally just a blank
beige wall
behind me. All of the various Georgia memorabilia and credentials and flags I normally have hanging ever so perfectly positioned for our live shots that we have.
Wait, there's a trophy that's usually up there that I don't see.
What, sports Emmy.
That's the one.
Funny story. we closed on the house on Tuesday and are officially going to be, you know, hitting the road with the movers on Saturday. And so I drove up. I have a Jeep, not the kind of Jeep you have, a Jeep Grand Cherokee. And so I packed the car with basically what I thought was the most valuable things to me that I would not want movers to mishandle. So what I brought up were TVs, golf clubs, my grilling accessories, of course, since I couldn't fit all of my five grills in the car, and my sports Emmy.
But all the accessories, yes.
Those are the things.
And your sports Emmy.
And my sports, those are the things that I packed in the car that I didn't absolutely could not take a risk that they would break.
That's what I want to do this week. So when we send the link out, I want to send the link out. What are the things you would pack into a Grand Cherokee that are most valuable to you?
Sports Emmy, golf clubs, grilling accessories, and TVs. Actually, I didn't do
nothing about your wife or your son. Nothing about any family heirlooms. Nothing related to your family whatsoever. It's golf.
I mean, the movers aren't responsible for my wife and child. I would actually bring my cat. I'd actually bring my cat. I got an orange cat, Crumbs, and I've got a golden retriever, Stella. The movers can do what they want with the dog. She's a little bit of a psycho, but I wouldn't have minded the cat for going up there. But I didn't want to leave him alone for a couple of days while the painters do your thing. I didn't get to do the podcast last week. You did it with T. Lou. I'm sure it was an incredibly boring episode, but I did want to circle back. How did the graduation party barbecue go?
It went very well. I think you and I went through this. I actually did pulled pork. I did it the day before. And then there was a lot of, you and I had a lot of back and forth about it. You were not a fan of it at first, but then I think you
but
did
then
research.
I, but then I did a little more research since I actually haven't done this myself.
No, it was very good. I don't remember much about the party. It was a very large party. I was told that at one
point. You don't remember much about the party. How many LPAs?
No, because hardly any at all, because I was on the grill all day long. That was the point, because I did wings, I did burgers, I did pulled pork. Like, I was feeding the world. And so I was kind of just constantly on the line. I was cooking all day long, but it was good.
How did the pulled pork come out after all that research that we did?
There was none left. And I got a lot of compliments. So I'm going to say it was good. I didn't eat any of it because, as I said, I spent all day laboring over a grill.
I feel like that's what happens with these parties. I certainly remember that happened with our wedding, where we paid just an ungodly amount of money to feed the 100 people who showed up at the wedding. I didn't have any. I did not have any of the entree. If people say, "Oh, the food was excellent," wouldn't know.
Yeah.
Didn't have a bite.
Same thing for us. I think we had some cake that night when the party was over and we got back to the hotel room at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. But that was about it for us. All right, your last from the 407 area code. But next week, both of us are at Torrey Pines. Make sure you check us out. That'll do it for this edition of Golf Central Podcast, presented by Callaway Golf.